Welcome. This is Marcia for Radio Eye, and today I will be reading National Geographic Magazine, dated July 2022. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Please join me now for the first article titled Sinking Fast by Adi Rinaldi. As the north coast of Java, Indonesia, fades away, residents struggle to keep their homes and their history from the same fate. To bury Mukmina last year, they had to bring in the dirt by rowboat. The cemetery was underwater in Timbul Sloko, a village some 250 miles east of Jakarta, the Indonesian capital. On maps, the village looks like it's still on the north coast of central Java, but the land around it has lately been taken by the Java Sea. The cemetery, a few hundred yards outside the village, had been submerged even at low tide since 2020. There was a dead tree in the middle of it, surrounded by dozens of headstones sticking out of the water. Mukmina was in her early 70s when she died. She would have remembered, as surviving elders do well, how green and prosperous their village once was. Paddy fields stretched as far as the eye could see. Villagers grew coconuts, red onions, chilies, cabbage, carrots, potatoes. Whatever seeds you threw to the ground, they would grow, recalls Ashar, the village leader. He's lean and muscular and only 39, but he too remembers the better days. The water has come on fast in just the past 2 decades. The north coast of Java is sinking and the sea is rising. In Jakarta, a city of more than 10 million, as much as 40% of the land is below sea level. But Demak Regency, which includes Timbul Sloko, is one of the hardest hit areas. While global warming is raising sea levels worldwide by around an eighth of an inch a year, the land here is sinking as much as 4 inches. Demak is losing more than 1,000 acres, about 0.5% of its area, each year. In Timbul Sloko, after rice crops failed in the 1990s, the villagers shifted to aquaculture, breeding milkfish and tiger prawns in brackish ponds. They had a few good years, but by the mid-2000s, the pond, too, had been swamped. Now the mainland is more than a mile away, and the villagers travel there by rowboat. To stay dry in their houses, they've installed wooden decks or raised the floors as high as 6 feet. They bend over under the low ceilings of their dwarf houses, as they call them. Of more than 400 families that once lived here, about 170 are left. The cemetery is one of the last things that connect them with their history. 7 men were tasked to prepare the burial ground for Mukmina. They dug into the mud for about an hour, building a dike around the hole. Their hoes struck the bones of an earlier burial. They kept digging, shirtless and soaked. They dug until the high tide filled the hole. Mukmina was buried 7 hours later, in the night, when the tide had ebbed and the water in the hole was only ankle deep. She was buried under more than a ton of loose, light brown soil that the men had rowed over from the mainland. You can't bury the body with mud and water, Ashtar says, so we have to buy fresh soil. It isn't easy to live here, as you can see, he goes on. Ashtar can't afford to leave because nobody wants to buy his dwarf house in the sea. The elders don't want to leave. They want to live with their memories close to their ancestors. After the funeral, the villagers pleaded with the Demak government for help. In the fall, it provided funding for a backhoe to scrape enough mud off the shallow seafloor to raise the whole cemetery 5 feet. That will buy the dead in Timbul Sloko a little more time. Demak Regency today has around 1.2 million inhabitants, a small fraction of Jakarta's population. But in the late 15th century, it was an independent Muslim sultanate that dominated the north coast. The Grand Mosque, built during that period as a center of Islamic teaching, still stands in the town of Demak. Thousands of pilgrims a year visit the tombs of the Wali Sango, or 9 saints, who helped spread Islam on Java. Demak is known as the City of the Saints. The North Coast Road, built in the 19th century along the length of Java by the Dutch colonial government, runs through Demak Regency. It's still a major artery, carrying some 400 trucks an hour. Factories lining the road produce everything from fertilizer and textiles to electronic devices. But tidal floods now repeatedly inundate it at great cost. There are several causes of the floods, and of the fact that Central Java has lost 20,000 acres of land, a lot of it in Damak. Sea level rise due to global warming is one factor, but land subsidence is another. Java's north coastal plain consists of dozens to hundreds of feet of alluvial sediment deposited over millennia by rivers flowing from inland mountains. The sediment sinks as it compacts under its own weight, explains Aaron Meltzner, a geologist at the Earth Observatory of Singapore at Nanyang Technical University. This is a very natural process, Meltzner says, but because the river is bringing more sediment, as the existing sediment compacts, more mud gets built on top and the delta stays above water. At least that's what used to be happening. As the rivers jumped their banks during annual floods and as their channels migrated back and forth through the soft mud, they spread sediment evenly across the plain. The flooding, however, threatened modern cities. In the late 19th century, the Dutch built canals, levees, and sluice gates as flood controls in the major cities, especially Jakarta and Semarang, the capital of Central Java. Today, the levees and concrete embankments keep the rivers from flooding, but also prevent them from replenishing the plain. Instead, sediment falls to the riverbed or shoots straight out to sea. That's one reason the north coast is sinking. Even in the absence of sea level rise, just the fact that we channelized the rivers and prevented them from migrating means that the natural process has been interrupted, Meltzner says. Harry Andreas, a researcher at the Bandung Institute of Technology, who studies the sinking coast, says another factor is at work, massive groundwater extraction, which is causing the sediments to compact faster. In Damak Regency alone, as of 2014, there were almost 250,000 wells, some up to 650 feet deep, in an area the size of Berlin. There probably are more wells by now. 2014 is the latest year for which government data are available. Most are private, but the Damak Water Authority has also drilled a dozen deep wells. It uses them to supplement river water and provide tap water to more than 61,000 households in 59 villages, out of 249 in the Regency. In 2019, it distributed at least 9.1 million cubic meters of groundwater. For more than a decade, researchers say the local government has promoted groundwater as the cheapest way to meet the pressing demand for drinking water and sanitation. It's clean and requires no treatment plants, dams, or reservoirs. But using it here exacts a high price. People, especially the government, keep blaming sea level rise as the main cause of the loss of land in Damak, Andreas says. But our conclusion is that the main culprit turns out to be decades of groundwater exploitation. Damak's public water network still serves only a minority of the Regency's population, and it doesn't reach Sayung District, which includes Timbul's Sloko, where the worst subsistence is taking place. In the village of Sayung, residents have drilled more than a dozen deep wells to supply about 2,000 families. The water is stored in elevated tanks and costs around 20 cents per cubic meter, cheaper than the public network. It's been a good business with good profit, says Munawir, the 40-year-old village leader who spends about $13 a month himself for water service. The 49-foot deep well his father drilled in his backyard in the 1980s is unusable now, contaminated by seawater. Of course, we hope that the government can provide a tap water network to prevent the sinking of the land, Munawir says, but it will also kill the already established local water business. The local government says drilling deep wells requires official permits and that unregistered wells will be shut down, but it hasn't closed any in recent years. Komarol Huda, head of the Damak Water Authority, blamed water shortages in the Regency. On farmers who draw too much from rivers for irrigation. He declined to comment on groundwater extraction. As Damak's population and industry continue to grow, groundwater extraction will too. No one is willing or able to invest the immense sums needed to build an alternative. For a decade, the Central Java provincial government and non-governmental organizations have been struggling to protect the coast from erosion. The government claims to have planted in excess of 3 million mangroves on more than 900 acres since 2011 to buffer waves and tides. The plan is no doubt that by 2023. Meanwhile, environmental NGOs working with local fisherfolk in Sayung District have built miles of bamboo fences just offshore. The fences act as permeable breakwaters that trap sediment stirred up by waves, especially during monsoon storms. They're cheap and meant to be temporary. The idea is to trap just enough sediment for mangroves to take root, but they collapse easily and often have to be repaired. We have yet to feel the impact of this coastal engineering, says Fadoli, a 36-year-old fisherman hired by an NGO to maintain a sediment trap in the village of Bedono. We haven't seen sediment build up here because the current keeps washing it away. The fences do act as breeding grounds for mussels, however, which residents collect and sell. Researchers at Diponegoro University in Semarang have tested other methods of coastal protection. At Timbulsloko in 2012, they built a seawall of concrete cylinders along 500 feet of former coastline. Within 2 years, enough sediment had built up behind the wall to grow mangroves, which today stand up to 10 feet tall. But concrete is too expensive to be a large-scale solution, says Denny Nugroho Sugianto, an oceanography professor at Diponegoro. Where waves are low enough, he advocates permeable breakwaters of bamboo and PVC pipe, more durable than bamboo and still cheap. But, he adds, we haven't solved the problem of sinking land, so no matter how many breakwaters we build, they won't be successful. The national government is part of a strategic effort to save vital assets and industrial zones, is building a combined highway and seawall from Semarang to the town of Damak, a distance of 17 miles. It's expected to be finished in 2024 at a cost of $532 million. But only small parts of two villages will be protected. The move angers residents of villages outside the wall, such as Timbulsloko and Sayung, who feel their communities are being left to drown. Central Java Governor Gunjar Pranowo, a tall 53-year-old with graying hair and a boyish smile, acknowledges the plan's limitations. He says the government simply can't afford to build bigger seawalls, as in the Netherlands, to protect more of the coast. Huge pumping stations would be needed to evacuate floodwaters from behind the wall. The system would require maintenance indefinitely. The government doesn't have the money, Pronowo says. So what should people do in the flooding villages, the ones accessible only at low tide along narrow footpaths, the ones where water laps at the villagers' feet in their living rooms? The last resort is to relocate to a safer place, says Pranowo, who's expected to run for president of Indonesia in 2024. Or if they insist on living there, they have to adapt to the environment by building stilt houses, for example. If they want their land back just like the old times, it's impossible. It's drowned now. In Central Java, the Muslim tradition is to visit the cemetery in the late afternoon on Thursdays. One recent Thursday, Husnamarom, a 16-year-old high school student, made his way to the cemetery in Timbulsloko. Dressed in a traditional white shirt, black songkok cap, and dark gray trousers, he walked barefoot on a narrow 6-foot-high boardwalk nearly 2 miles long that residents built last year to replace the vanished roads. He made a right turn down wooden stairs and crossed a creek on the slippery, submerged road. The tidal flood reached knee-deep, but his steps were confident. On the other side, he climbed back onto the boardwalk and continued on. When he reached the underwater cemetery, the shadows had begun to fall. The dead tree and the headstones were silhouetted against the deep orange sky. Husnamarom found the grave of his grandmother, Mukmina. He raised his hands and began to pray. Husnamarom knows from bedtime stories, including the ones Mukmina told him, how his village used to be. The memories will die with the older generation, and sooner or later the stories too will fade. Like many other youths, Husnamarom doesn't plan to stay in Timbulsloko. I know what this village looked like, he says, but we see and experience what it has now become. He'll look for a job in the city when he graduates. He wants to be a software engineer. The next article from the August 2022 National Geographic. The Immortal Marks of Stars by Liz Croesi. On glass plates of starscapes, women astronomy pioneers inked insights and analyses. Many were erased, a few became art. The print that artist Erica Blumenfeld shows me is an expanse of deep blue, a rich color that speaks of romance and night. It's stippled with gold marks, some as lines, some as arrows, some as dots. Her art is formed by ink on paper, but it's rooted in century-old artifacts, inspired by unsung astronomy pioneers, and animated by a quest to understand light. At the Harvard College of Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, three floors of metal cabinets house more than 550,000 glass plates, most of them 8 by 10 inches, a photographic negative format dating from the mid-19th century. These plates recorded astronomical data from telescopes trained on celestial regions and objects. One side bears the print of light from distant stars. The other side had been marked with equations, arrows, circles, letters, and other notations by women who were hired to interpret the data. From 1885 until the 1950s, hundreds of so-called women computers studied the plates. They discovered how variations in brightness of specific stars revealed their energy output, a relationship that provided a way to measure great distances. They examined a star's light spectrum and determined that the intensities of the star's colors indicated its chemical composition. They counted and cataloged galaxies. With such discoveries, these women laid the foundation for modern astrophysics. They left marks of many kinds. On some of the plates, only a few arrows or characters. On others, notes from conversations between women across decades, each striving to better understand the universe. Then the marks were removed from roughly 470,000 plates, so that the world's researchers could access the plates' historic trove of astronomical data. The collection needed to be digitized. In the early 2000s, Harvard astrophysicist Jonathan Grindley began a project that's now nearly complete, digital access to a Sky Century at Harvard, or DASCH, an archive of digital scans from the bulk of the collection. According to Grindley, getting the clearest image of a glass plate's astronomical data requires eliminating all marks on the other side of the plate before scanning. This is the process. Each plate is placed on a table with its non-astronomical data side, that is, the area where the women computers had written their observations, measurements, and notes, facing up. After an overhead camera photographs that side, the plate is moved to an area where all marks are erased by scrubbing with an ethanol water mixture, and, if necessary, scraping with a razor blade. By the time Blumenfeld heard about this process in 2019, more than 400,000 plates had been scanned. When I learned that they were actually wiping the plates clean of the marks, I was deeply saddened, she tells me. She set out to preserve the beauty and meaning of the marks, if only on a handful of plates. In honor of the women whose marks inspired her own, Blumenfeld calls her art Tracing Luminaries. Blumenfeld's father says the first word she spoke, standing in her crib pointing at the fixture overhead, was light. Her fascination with light was there somehow from the beginning, she says. That affinity led her to take up photography in high school in the late 1980s and later earn a degree in it from Parsons School of Design. In the years between, Blumenfeld created art inspired by light and ways to capture it. But she draws a distinction. Unlike some artists and photographers, she's not interested in capturing the way light reflects off landscapes or people. She aims to capture the light itself. Starting in the late 1990s, Blumenfeld began building novel lensless cameras uniquely geared to collecting celestial light, from the faint to the squintingly bright. As she made art from the beams of lunar phases, sun cycles, and solstices, Blumenfeld launched what would become continuing engagements with scientific researchers and data. I'm always looking for connections, Blumenfeld says. like the shared traits that she believes connect scientists and artists, an inquisitive nature, strong powers of observation, a gift for thinking deeply about the natural world. She sees those attributes clearly in the words and drawings on the glass plates. The marks are the material evidence of the women's passion for and devotion to their research, she says, and to the stars themselves. Art that would preserve the women computers' contributions, that's what Blumenfeld wanted to create. By 2019, she had devised a plan to transfer the marks themselves, the ink laid by the women's hands, from the plates onto another material. Harvard gave Blumenfeld permission to try that approach with 50 select plates, starting in mid-March 2020. But before the artists could begin, the COVID-19 pandemic forced Harvard to close its facilities to visitors. The DASH project in-house work continued, photographing a plate's hand-inscribed side, wiping it clean, then scanning its astronomical data side. As the pandemic stretched on, plates that Blumenfeld had hoped to use in her art slipped out of reach. Some of the plates with distinctive markings or historical value were permanently secured in a special archive named the Wilhelmina Fleming Collection after one of Harvard's groundbreaking women computers and astronomers. Other plates that Blumenfeld had hoped to protect were run through the scanning process, all of their marks removed. Without access to the physical plates, Blumenfeld resorted to working virtually. She spent weeks looking through thousands of plate photographs in the DASH digital image portal. Eventually, she chose images of 6 plates, observations made from 1892 through 1923, including views of both the small and large Magellanic clouds, the Taurus and Pegasus constellations, and Jupiter with its 8th moon. Blumenfeld shared the digital images of the plates with printmaking collaborators at the Design and Visual Arts School of Washington University in St. Louis. The team mapped a creation process from this first step. "We basically did the inverse of what DASH did," Blumenfeld says. "They wiped the marks, I wiped the stars, so the marks could stand alone." Based on those marks, each piece took shape through a combination of historical art techniques, new technology, and materials that struck Blumenfeld as the stuff of stars. The result, tracing luminaries, a portfolio of 6 gold leaf prints. It tells the story of women who studied light to understand the universe, who saw the stars in a way others of their time did not, of a love language to those stars across generations, and an effort to honor that language and those women. "From the beginning," Blumenfeld tells me, "my whole idea was to return their marks to the stars somehow." She may have, in her way, by bringing those who left the marks and their discoveries and achievements out from the shadows into the light. Starlight Art. When the pandemic kept artist Erica Blumenfeld from accessing the glass plates to salvage the women's original marks, she found another way, one that combined modern technology with ancient printmaking methods. Collaborating with a research-based studio, Island Press, at Washington University in St. Louis, she began with the digital photos captured during the DASH scanning process and removed all the pixels in those images other than the women's marks. Blumenfeld and her collaborators uploaded that digital file to a machine that etched the marks onto acrylic plates. They applied transparent ink onto the etched plates and then pressed each one onto deep blue paper, which at the same time was pressed against thicker backing paper. The intaglio process embossed the blue paper, with the plates' marks lifting off the sheet. The transparent ink acted as an adhesive for the final touch, 24-karat gold leaf. Trailblazers of astronomy. Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who, upon finding more than 2,000 stars whose light pulsed, realized that how quickly those changed was a way to measure inherent brightness and distance. Annie Jump Cannon, who used temperature differences among stars to revolutionize a classification system that astronomers still use. "Even though most of these women worked in obscurity, they were trailblazers," says Zuhl, who has since left the observatory. "Astrophysics today would not be what it is without the work that the women were doing." Biodiversity. Shells suffer from liberal harvesting. Horse conches America's largest sea snails are at greater risk of extinction after a century of unregulated harvesting of their shells, a new study finds. Using chemical isotopes from conch shells to gauge age and reproductive maturity, scientists found that females spawn late in life. Overharvesting could cost many that chance. Though the horse conch is Florida's state seashell, gathering it there isn't limited, a step that could help save it, says study author Gregory S. Herbert. Ganging up to eat. Video taken at Australia's Ningaloo Reef shows that whole sharks can hunt baitfish in tandem with other predators. Whale sharks are known to chase fish on their own, but they're relatively slow swimmers. When speedier animals such as tuna and diving birds force prey into a defensive ball, the largest mouth gets the most fish. This behavior, rarely documented, may be a way for the giant sharks to save energy while foraging. Nicklin, a National Geographic explorer, spends a lot of time immersed in the frigid waters around the world's icy environments. During one trip to Antarctica, he pulled on his dry suit to photograph blue-eyed shags, which also have pink feet. The gregarious birds breed in colonies on the Antarctic Peninsula and can be quite curious. As Nicklin stayed motionless in the ocean, several youngsters, including several attached to its mother, approached him and pecked inquisitively on the dome covering his camera. Remote and rugged, Big Bend, named for a large curve in the Rio Grande that forms its southern border, is one of the contiguous United States' largest and most remote national parks. It's home to an entire mountain range, fossils dating back 500 million years, and unusually rich biodiversity, thanks in part to its three distinct ecosystems, river canyons, desert floor, and isolated mountains. Chisos Mountains Range. Bears and mountain lions roam among oak and pine trees in this sky island, which rises 4,500 feet above the desert floor and can be 20 degrees cooler. Farmed fossils. Big Bend's fossil record features 40-foot crocodiles and one of the largest pterosaurs ever found. The record extends from the park's oceanic beginnings to the extinction of dinosaurs and the rise of mammals. Overlapping habitats. Endangered plant and animal species and others that are at the extreme limits of their ranges, such as the Mexican black bear and the quaking aspen, can be found here. Odd juxtapositions include cacti growing on beds of moss. This concludes readings from National Geographic magazine for today. Your reader has been Marcia. If you've enjoyed hearing this content, please give us a call at 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening and have a great day.